before time and space and matter, anything that would be of other defined than that would have to be operating in the laws of God, in the laws of ideas of God, things not seen, bringing forth things that are seen. If that be the case, then things that are spanced across the formlessness or the tohu, vabohu, that means also the void and formlessness, things can be placed, quote, to our time and space, billions of miles away, billions of light years away. Yet before time and space, it could not be measured as such. 48 billion light years away at the event prior to the event horizon of creation could be one and the same. The idea of ideas is that things placed by the idea maker had no problem placing such things on the coat hanger of the universe that would be to come. At creation point, we have found by NASA that we are the center of the universe. We find there are three walls that contain the galaxies and stars that are very thin. And in between these three walls is formlessness and void. They're all traveling away from the center point of the creation, which has now been confirmed as us. And if one were to look at the collectiveness of the void and formlessness and these three very thin walls that contain all of the galaxies and stars, one would see a sphere, a ball. If these existed at the creation point of an explosion, light therefore could have been instantaneously with us, as well as the ever so traveling farther away from us, equidistantly, galaxies and stars that are now confirmed at the farthest to be 48 billion light years away. That is to say, the explosion before anything else, the creation point, the explosion, the exacting point of time and space and matter could have spanced itself at that point to be, let's say, 20 billion light years away. Let's say 47 billion light years away. Let's say 48 billion light years away. But that would have been before light and years and time and spans and matter were in their form. Therefore, NASA believes that we, as the Earth is concerned, in our universe is 24 billion years old. So what does that say? That if our creation point is here at the center of our universe, how can these things be 48 billion light years away when we haven't even had that much time to have existed since the creation or the Big Bang would have been estimatedly at 24 billion years old or ago? This gives us a concern about our ever-expanding universe in the micro-sense, our own universe, our own Earth even, expanding in a relative fashion. We ourselves might be expanding, not understanding or seeing that, since we are relative to ourselves. Point being taken, if there is a creation point that happened in under a microsecond, or a second, then all things preceding that would be remnant of the instantaneousness of all of creation. Or should I say, it would not be unbelievable to say that our Earth is and our universe is 15,000 years old, or that it would be 10,000 years old. If time and space and matter are compressed in such a fashion. The bigger point is that the universal concept of expansion and creation, in the universal sense, can be applied to the universal concept of expansion of the creation point of our stories of beginning, such as in the book of Genesis. But such creation points infer the supernatural. Such creation points, prior to the buildings and things of trees and birds and air, time and space, have to infer to something before that, if it be an account of a supernatural occurrence. Otherwise, all occurrences are bound by the law of naturalism or cosmogenesis. This cosmogenetic approach to creation can be found in many of the new techniques applied to how mythologies have their common source or common ancestral source. This new, quote, technique has brought some other various, and I believe, perverted viewpoints to the idea that the creation and the creator come all from a biological impulse as idea. And furthermore, another technique that has been brought to the table for this cosmogenesis approach concerning the creator, the creation, is that many of the ancients have taken strong hallucinogenic drugs to have seen the, quote, spirit world. This in itself leads to other various perversions of the Genesis account. Keep in mind, I said the cosmogenesis, meaning from the creation, came the idea of creation or creation itself. And this in itself denies itself any further rights. Tonight, I'm going to make the argument for the creator as supernatural and transcendent, coming from an external source, we receive this. Or should I say, this transcendent supernatural God is the external source that we are bound to and by, and we did not generate him, he generated us. I'm also going to make the argument that all cosmogenetic mythologies or mythologies made by man are seen using the ideas of man, his place in time, trees, birds, and all of the other animation that we have surrounding us. Further to this, I'm going to make the statement or the point in this lecture that any mythologies coming from any point of the world that have the idea of a supernatural creator are going to be more affixed or in line with the original source of Genesis. Let's go to an old source called the Akkadian culture, which was nearly correlative with Sumeria in their existence. They came a little bit later. They believe it was the Al-Ubaid culture that was considered the Proto-Sumerian. We don't know exactly if they were in conjunction with Sumerians or not, but the Al-Ubaid and Proto-Sumerian to Sumerian early cultures preceded the Akkadian culture, I'm sure, at least by 500 years. But let's start with the Akkadian offshoot of Sumerian mythologies, which we will later touch on. But the Akkadian mythologies, starting with their very word for create, since that is a lot of our focus, is creation. Creation point, creation mythology, or creation theology. The Akkadian word or verb for create is banu. Now, the other is called basamu. The former is used generally with a whole range of meanings, including, quote, build, construct, form, make, manufacture, end quote, and is sometimes translated as, quote, create. This comes closer to my last lecture on Cain as forging, making. This comes in line with the line of hero and not Messiah. Once again, though it be a cosmogenetic mythology or theology, or should I say ideology, it reflects by its bigger brother or distant relative, the messianic line, which gives conference to a creation point by a creator, which is supernatural and transcendent, not bound by the laws of man, his nature, or the laws that govern him. Let me continue. When a deity is the subject in a cosmic context, objects are the following. And I say cosmic, I'm referring to the cosmos or the creation. Once again, this would make God under the laws of man, or at least under the laws that man are bound by. Number one, such as humankind or individual humans. This is one of the contexts you would find in a mythology or mythopoeia or mythopoeia that was made or manufactured by man. And I say the heroic line of thinking. Check the Messiah versus Hero CD. Another one would be the heavens. See, if you can see this, when Anu had created the heaven had created the earth. Now, let me back this up. When Anu had created the heaven had created the earth. The earth had created the rivers. Offices. Now, this is going into this cosmogenesis, that one is bound to the other one. You can see the Logeia series for that one about temporal clauses, being in the temporal clause, one binding the other one. The next, we have offices such as high priests and kingships. This is also cosmic in its nature. It has to do with hierarchies of mankind. Mountains. We see mountains. We look up to those things. We see they're already created. Let me continue. Various abstract features, examples, the womb that produces features, warfare, conjuration, quote, just injustice. Another feature of cosmic features is evil, wind, barley, and flax. We see functions such as created stars to destroy evil ones. There's a sense of good and evil, if you will, bound by the laws of man. Prior to the laws of man, it was simply what it was. It was bound by God, and there was no calamity to be had, for God would not create calamity on himself. Likewise, as Jesus said, can a devil cast out a devil? Or if I be a God, why would I, and you call me a devil, why would I cast myself out? There's a law of contradiction there. We also have a plan or situation. Once again, there's no situation given to God, if he is all in all creative. These are the functions or the things that we see in a cosmogenetic mythology, a creation made by man and not by God. It does not have the elements of the supernatural. Further, the term Basamu is used more reservedly. Its objects include buildings or plans for them, usually sanctuaries, pictures, examples, such as reliefs or stelas, an arable land, example, by buildings or dikes, people in the womb, strategies, weapons, magical ones for the gods, divine images, cosmic components, constellations, firmament, which is called the Buramu. Okay, once again, these are objects that are found in a cosmogenetic mythology. Let's keep on going here. So, for fewer resources are available for doing lexical and concordance and investigations in Egyptian, if you will. A number of Egyptian words are occasionally translated to, quote, create. The main ones are called chaper and shaper, meaning to evolve, or iri, which means to make. It's misi, or msi, meaning to beget, which is where you get the word Messiah from. Mesha, that means to carry over. That's also Sumerian. Mesh, such as Ramses, if you will. Ramses is back to Egyptian, but Ra of the sun, Mesh, to be begotten of the sun. Hermes, it comes from Ham. It's the Akkadian concept for Ham, or name for Ham, which meant the one who began the confounding, but Hermesh is the one of the Her. Hermes is the interpreter, and we found that Cush was the great interpreter. He was the man who seemed to have two faces, such as Janus and Hephaestus. He was the great interpreter, the one who also carried the club. He is also referred to as Bel, and so was his father. And so he is in the line with his father of being the confounder. So let's continue here. mystery to beget, or misty to beget. And it also kim, it means to form or to fashion something. The echo through a cosmogenic mythology that pervades, where the deity pervades through, is whenever we see that whenever the deity is subject, then the objects of these verbs that we have put out indicate a larger functional sense rather than anything strictly material, much in line with what emerged in the other languages. There's a definite reflection from one language to the other concerning these ideas of creation, and furthermore, to study the idea of the science of morphology of languages, we see how that one culture has affected the speech patterns of the other one. You can go into Verner's and Grimm's Law on that one. Likewise, in a theogony or theosophy, you see the same type of morphologies or morphologic laws taking place within this context. And here I'm already trying to paint the picture of this sphere that we discussed earlier concerning the universe as accreted whole by the space shots of the Hubble telescope. So we're getting to this idea of diffusion from the central source, all diffusions being equidistant and showing remnancy of the central creation point. As I've stated earlier, there's always an argument for every statement made concerning the Bible that ultimately doesn't hold its own because it doesn't have a network of thought or logic or doctrine to establish the very poignant argument that it's making against the biblical theme. The biblical theme being a unified whole or a unified doctrine, such as the case for the word bara concerning the to create in the Bible. Well, the words are defined by the context. The context holds the particulars. The particulars are held together by the universal theme. This is why this is a new speech, new language, a new heaven and earth, if you will, in terms of speech, dabar, as we said in the Hebrew, shem in the Hebrew, and logos in the Greek. These are, or the rhema, going forth and speaking out. So these are the new languages or linguistics that we use concerning this. As I've said before, that I do not believe the Bible is a cosmogenetic mythology. Rather, it is a transcendental story and guide and doctrine given to us by a supernatural transcendent God. Therefore, bara, in its context, being a particular word in the universal sense and defined by the context of the Bible, is defined as a supernatural event and not a word that conveys over the building of something in terms of man's hands. Further than that, I equate this bara as the Genesis 1, verse 1 account of bara. So it, once again, we're becoming more particular concerning that word. In other instances of bara, it is loose in terms of creating or establishing something that has already been in the cosmos. We can see that in the in a sociological sense, in Psalms 102, verse 19, Ezekiel 21:35, and concerning cities, if you will, Isaiah 65, verse 8, in terms of the word bara, creating cities. We see this also in Exodus 34:10, Numbers 16:30, Isaiah 45:7, Amos 4:13. And if you want to get into creating praise or purity in a very abstract idea as of righteousness, we can say bringing forth or brought about by the affectation, the passionate affectation of God in Psalms 51, verse 21, and Isaiah 57, 19. These are the terms of thalos, or the will of desire, which is not our generated will, as we have seen in the doctrine of Romans chapter 9, that it's not of the will of man nor the will of anything, but of God who shows mercy. So it is of God who is creating anything that we do. It is Him who wills in us to do His good will. We can see that in Colossians 1, I believe 1:16, 1:15, Philippians chapter 3 and following. Or read it in the context, and you'll see that it's God giving praise to God for His will being done. We can further this idea later, but right now the idea is that bara, used in this particular sense of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, is a word specific for the creation of God making the universe. So in that case, we have this. That's that. And if we go to such studies as the Greeks and their form of chaos and cosmos, We can see the word cosmos being maybe more closely associated with our language, the English language, in that it's Greek, and our language is based on Latin and Greek and Old Germanic, which is Indo-European, the idea of cosmos, which means an orderly arrangement. It means the arranged order of things that might come closer to our perception, but maybe not. And we can find that in earlier classical writings, such as Hesiod's Theogony and Virgil's Aeneid. Chaos itself is personified as the primal state in which the earth, sky, and seas were all merged. So chaos itself is a good term that banks with the Tohu Babohu and the Mayim that settled in it. So it has to do with what I would say a supernatural or a relevant supernatural theme that is transcendent, or at least it has ties with the transcendent act. But with that said, there are earthly or cosmic ties to that that can go both ways. And if you will, more generically, if you will, chaos is the opposite in the Greek mind of cosmos, which refers to the ordered whole. So, you know, chaos and cosmos, to the Greek mind, here's a good example of more cosmic ideas versus transcendental, is that they're opposite. We know that there is no opposition in God, and from the creation point in the supernatural story, it is being God, God ordered all things and God called all things. Nothing is disordered or opposite of one another. They go in conjunction with one another. So they're running more parallel than, if you will, opposite. There is no opposition with God nor his laws. What we would do is say is perception is opposition, or you can say opposition to the flesh. That is one good example of opposition in its nature going against the spiritual nature, but not the law of God. And again, we have probably an earlier Minoan Greek influence on the Egyptians, possibly not, who knows. I think so. For they were speaking hieratic Greek, I believe that is. They were also probably speaking Coptic, but they believe now that the Coptic language that's been retained or brought over had some was basically Old Egyptian in its nature, not Arabic, but Old Egyptian. But we have here in the psyche of the Egyptian mind, earlier mind, a quote. It says right here, what lies out of the biosphere of earth, sky, and duat is not nothingness, but a universe that is the antithesis of all that defines the world. It is infinite where the world is bounded, formless and chaotic where the world is shaped and ordered, inert where the world is active and wholly uniform in substance, meaning water, where the world is materially diverse. And so we have our old religion of dualities or opposites, and this pervades through the Persian religion based on Ahura Mazda, the corruption of it, if you will, about Ahriman versus Ahura Mazda, the evil that goes against the good. You have a good and evil, and one is going to win. Well, this is not a biblical definition of a creator calling all things into existence, as Isaiah 45 states, I, the Lord, create both good and evil for my own good pleasure. But this is in relevance to us. This has to do with us. It is God driving it to him. It is not evil because he is not evil. And this goes into Occam's razor argument. But God ultimately is the causer of all things. Therefore, he is not bound to anything. And here's a deeper argument that C.S. Lewis might have posed or did pose. That if God were to change all good things into evil, then, quote, the evil would then become good, because good is a generator. And as my study with Job and Macbeth is concerned, Shakespeare took the literary device of poetry to reverse the roles where it could not be done in the real world, that evil would become a generator. But even in that world, grace itself, unmerited favor, and true grace, graciousness, still pervades that very muck of existence that did bad, quote, would be a generator. So even in the laws of poetry and not the reality laws, grace still abides as the victor. Let's continue with this reverse morphology. Like I said, we're going to go back and forward with the morphologies concerning a theogony in theosophy of the world accounts from all the different cultures. So if we go back to the ancient Near East, which is getting closer and closer to the origin, if you will, of Adam and Eve, as the Bible has stated, and I believe that it very well can be in the steppe region as well as is Iraq, Tigris-Euphrates, but I believe we're getting into a closer account of the Tigris and Euphrates concerning Adam and Eve. So let's continue here with this pre-creation condition that the earlier ancients were coming to. The morphology takes hold, and the idea of chaos defined as a human or God personified becomes less and less. It becomes secondary, which means this, that as the further you go back, the laws of morphology of theogony and theosophy take hold, and we get closer and closer to a oneness of cause and a secondariness, if you will, of the creation. To get more specific, in the ancient Near East, the ancient Near East, the pre-creation condition is therefore, and that's in terms of the theosophy or theology or mythology of the creation, is therefore neither an abstraction nor personified. Though the primordial sea, which is in the principal element of the pre-creation condition, is personified by Nammu in Sumer and by Nun in Egypt. Okay, we have these two accounts. The further you go back in Mesopotamia, chaos itself is personified only secondarily in the conflict myths. And once again, we're still within the man-made myths, but getting closer to the central source. And these conflict myths recount a jeopardy to the created order of things. So, but it's a secondary sense at this point. In this cosmological literature, the threatening creatures must be overthrown and order reestablished. So, once again, you're getting back to this whole ordered thing as far as you go back. And in this sense, a push for order is restored versus the cacophony of the gods who've gone amok and wild, one fighting the other, as we see in the Greeks, the later Greeks that Aristotle said is horrendous and a blasphemous treatment on the earlier myths. So we have Aristotle on our side on that. Now we can start to look at what we call the pre-cosmic condition, or a viewpoint of the earlier, the ancients, as to what their idea of the pre-cosmic condition was. So now we're actually extracting from the older cultures their opinion and idea of the oldest of ideas of the pre-cosmic condition, and not their stories in terms of the drama of good and evil, or even the drama of their idea or sense of the creator and the created, and then the chaos that came after that. We're getting back into a pre-chaos, pre-cosmic understanding. Cosmic does imply chaos, and chaos implies cosmic, because there are dualities in all of the earlier, even the earlier religions got into that. But let's go back to by extraction, as the Hubble telescope would, an extraction of an extraction of an extraction to the earlier pre-cosmic conditions. So this pre-cosmic condition was not lacking in that which was material. It was lacking in order and differentiation, which is consistent with its theme, because at this point we're not dealing with order or things and put in order or placement as the Greek tassemi. We're taking them out. We're going into a pre-dabar in the Hebrew state, which means ordered things or judgment. So this was these ideas of pre-cosmic order in the earlier ancients. They lacked a sense of order and differentiation, which is perfectly right in this morphology. Thus, the accounts regularly begin with a pre-cosmic and unordered non-functional world. And we're talking about, once again, what I just said. So creation then takes place by giving things order, function, and purpose, which is synonymous with giving them existence. Once established, the order that exists in the cosmos is constantly threatened with being undone. As a result, called creation itself is not restricted to a one-time event. Whether the jeopardy derives from the cosmic waters, from what we would term natural, quote-unquote, occurrences, from supernatural beings, or from human behavior, if you will, or simply from the darkness of each night. The gods are responsible for reestablishing order day by day and moment by moment. And so once again, you have this cacophony once order begins, once the established existence begins of this disorder. Of this fight for order, once again, dichotomy. But if you go back to Egypt, the first occasion, that means the first creation point, the god Amun is by himself the first of the gods. And despite the fact that Amun was said to exist before everything, he emerged himself from the waters. And there you go. It's giving this thing that he came out of something, so you still have a generative god, or it came out of something. So he in himself, of his own creation, is cosmogenic. So this, once again, is a reflection of the earlier man-made writers. So we can keep on going. So the Egyptian cosmology started with the non-existent, though. And so we still have this push for that, but the morphology still stands. It was still cosmogenic. But these non-existent pre-occurrences, which included the absence of space and forms, that is, sometimes some material aspects, but which was always made up of some kind of water and darkness, in which nothing was named or distinct. So here we have some idea of the ancients of ancients as this idea of water and chaos. And you can go to Ovid's Metamorphoses and see the same thing. So I've taken the Penguin classic, Ovid's Metamorphoses, and I've gone to book one, which is page 29. I'm going to read this. This is Ovid. Ovid existed from 43 BC to AD 17, so he's a perfect example of a thinker that existed during the time of Christ. So this is to show you the mentality of this Greek and Latin folklore and legend, Mythiopia, if you will, from even a greater writer than we have today, or should I say the greater classical sense of mind of creation. Anyway, let me go on here. This is Ovid talking. My purpose is to tell of bodies which have been transformed into shapes of a different kind. You heavenly power, since you were responsible for those changes, as for all else, look favorably on my attempts and spin an unbroken thread of verse. Okay, the spinners, we know the Fortunae, the Morae, the Greek Fates, and also you see them as the Scandinavian Norns sisters, or the Norn sisters. They always came in three. This is very cosmogenic, but check this out. This is the classical sense that goes back to the pre-cosmic idea. From the earliest beginnings of the world down to my own times, which is the time of Christ, before there was any earth or sea, before the canopy of heaven stretched overhead, nature presented the same aspect the world over, that to which men have given the name chaos. This is capital C for chaos. This was a shapeless, uncoordinated mass, nothing but a weight of lifeless matter whose ill-assorted elements were indiscriminately heaped together in one place. So once again, we're talking about disorder. Now, here's the deal with this one. He is referring to elements that were disordered. So he's getting into this idea of order-disorder, but he's at least touching the basis of primordial water mass, thing that's not put into order. So in this sense, we'll continue. There was no sun in those days to provide the world with light, no crescent moon ever filling out her horns. That also has to do with time. Mene was the Persian god of counting. We see that moon, or the goddess of counting, the menstrual cycles, the accounting of the woman's cycle. These have to do with this is the mythology, but this has to do with Inanna, Ishtar, and the countings of the crescent moon. The earth was not poised in the enveloping air, balanced there by its own weight, nor did the sea stretch out its arms along the margins of the shores. Although the elements of the land and air and sea were there, the earth had no firmness, the water no fluidity, there was no brightness in the sky. Nothing had any lasting shape, but everything got in the way of everything else. For within that one body, cold warred with hot. So here we go, the elements of war. Once again, this is giving away the morphology of this this Latin writer, Ovid, concerning the elements now of war that I mentioned in this lecture at the beginning. For within that body, cold warred with hot, moist with dry, soft with hard, and lights with heavy. So once again, these are the pairs of opposites here. This is based on a later religion, probably out of the Egyptians, if you will, and the early Greeks, the Minoans, and even the Akkadians. So let me continue. This strife was finally resolved by a god. This is small g. A natural force of a higher kind. So there's a naturalism of this god, but of a higher kind. So once again, cosmogenic in that it's relative to the cosmogenesis of this world. It's bound to a description by the world. This god, who separated the earth from heaven and the waters from the earth, and set the clear air apart from the cloudy atmosphere, when he had freed these elements, sorting them out from the heap where they had lain, indistinguishable from one another, he bound them fast, each in its separate place, forming a harmonious union. So once again, Ovid's coming from a sense that they were disarrayed, disordered, they were getting in the way of one another. There was disorder, and that they were fighting for one another, versus the supernatural theology of Genesis 1, where God caused it, and it was. And it automatically, instantaneously was ergative with its own right, and worked within the whole ecosphere, biosphere, and was perfect in its creation, all things being perfect. This is distinctive, and this is different than the later writers with a cosmogenic view. Okay, here we go further with Ovid. The fiery aether, which has no weight, formed the vault of heaven, flashing upwards to take its place in the highest sphere. The air next to it, in its lightness, occupied the neighboring regions. Earth, heavier than these, attracted to itself the grosser elements, and sank down under its own weight, while the encircling sea took possession of the last place of all, and held the solid earth in its embrace. In this way, the god, whichever of the gods it was, set the chaotic mass into order, and after dividing it up, arranged it into its constituent parts. Of course, we have the earlier Greeks. We say that chaos was a god. They did. And all things came out of chaos. So chaos personified order, fighting it. We see persona of the gods fighting chaos versus cosmos. Let's continue. When this was done, his first care was to shape the earth into a great ball, so that it might be the same in all directions. Now, isn't this interesting? Here is Ovid, 43 BC to 17, saying of the creation account, which is still so very close to the Bible, yet its morphology is affected by humanistic means, is a remnant of the older world, the older account, I believe it's a Genesis account, with its constituents tattoo, if you will, of man's opinion, of duality. This is in itself is a type of pureness to the reading of this classic. So when one can approach this classic at this era, 43 BC to 17 BC was his era, we can look at the duality taking place of the creation, yet the idea of disorder, or if you will, and which implies, of course, order, which implies, of course, duality, but still a sense of creation coming out of this primordial muck.